beautiful building and the exciting activities here, and I wish you can continue along this trend. So yesterday, Steve Schenker made a very strong point for considering toy models, simple solvable models that one can extract lessons from them. He gave the more complicated example of the Ising model. My favorite examples are actually the harmonic oscillator or the hydrogen atom. These are beautiful, simple systems. They could be misleading by their simplicity, but with the right insight, one can extract from them the correct physics. So I'll continue here along a path of many people who study these low-dimensional string theories as laboratories or toy models for string theory. And the reason these models are interesting, there are several reasons they are interesting. First, they're solvable, very much like the harmonic oscillator or the hydrogen atom or the Ising model. Second, there are very small numbers of really non-perturbative definitions of string theory. We've heard a lot about ADS-CFT. That gives us a non-perturbative definition. There is the BFSS matrix model. And there are these simple matrix models. The special thing about these low-dimensional string theories, these matrix models for them, is this whole class of models which are exactly well-defined non-perturbatively, these are the only ones which are actually solvable. So this is really heaven for doing laboratories. We have something that's completely well-defined, completely meaningful, non-perturbatively, and can be calculated. Furthermore, they exhibit rich number of phenomena. They have all of the phenomena that were popular during the last 10 years or so, like D-brains. In fact, I think it's fair to say that D-brains originated from the study of these matrix models. They have holography. I think it's fair to say that matrix models were one of the impetus for studying holography. Holography here is very, very important, and I'll say some things about it. It has non-perturbative effect, which is really a characteristic feature of physics or string theory during the last decade, which are calculable and interesting. They exhibit open-closed string duality. We can explore here backgrounds with Ramon-Ramon fluxes, or as they are known, flux vacua, and here they can be explored exactly. We can explore time dependence, and the list goes on and on. So I mentioned this open-closed duality. This is the only example of duality, where the two sides of the duality are exactly calculable. Normally in duality, we are very happy about duality because we have two systems. One of them is strongly coupled, the other is weakly coupled. They are the same. So we don't know how to solve the strongly coupled theory. So instead, we guess a dual description, and I strongly underscore guess a dual description, which is weakly coupled, and we solve the weakly coupled theory. And we're very happy that this teaches us something about the strong conflict behavior of another system. Here, on the other hand, we have a dual pair that both sides of the duality are calculable for the same range of parameters. And we will see some examples how physics happens, see the same physical phenomenon described from two different points of view. Both of them are calculable. It appears to happen for two different reasons. The mathematical reasons appear to be different. The bottom line physics turns out to be the same. So that gives new insights into all these phenomena that we will explore. So this subject has three points of view, and it's really important to distinguish between them. And the fact that it's easy to derive results from one point of view rather than from the others should not stop us from analyzing the system from all points of view, even if it's a little bit harder, in order to get new insights. The one that I will start with today is the world shape description. What can we do here? Here we can calculate the classical results. We can calculate a few one-loop corrections. And the main advantage of that is that the language that we will be using in the world sheet is very similar to the language of critical string theory. So when Clifford Johnson, I think Clifford gave here an introduction to string theory, or if you look at Polchinski's volume one, you can just take it from the recipes from there and just follow your nose, and that's what you're doing. And the lessons that we'll learn from here are applicable there. So that's the advantage of the world sheet description. The disadvantage is that we cannot do much beyond one loop correction. The calculations become very complicated, and it's practically impossible to do non-perturbative calculations. The second point of view is the target space. This is where it's easiest to describe the questions and to describe the answers. So we'll do an experiment, an S-matrix experiment. We throw something in, it bounces back out. We ask, what's the amplitude that it bounces back out? What do the fields look like? Most of the description of Ofer Aharoni's talk today was in the space-time. We wrote a space-time Lagrangian. We see Einstein's equations and so forth. However, in situations which are strongly coupled either on the world sheet or in space-time, in other words, either the curvature in space-time is large or the quantum mechanical fluctuations are large. In these two situations, the space-time description breaks down. And in the examples that we will be studying, this will always be the case. Therefore, we'll use the target space as a place to formulate our questions and to formulate the answers, but it will usually be very difficult to get the bridge between them. So this is the second point of view, the target space. The third is the metrics model, which I will not get to today, but only in the second talk. The metrics model gives us a non-perturbative definition, and it's very easy to calculate. I'll present some new ways of doing calculations in metrics model, which are completely elementary. The downside is that it's very difficult to interpret the answers. So this is like doing an experiment. You're presented with the result of the experiment, and you have to interpret the answers. And interpret the answers, I mean, take the answers back to the target space where we formulated the questions and where we would like to see the answer. So as part of introduction, I'd like finally to say that some of the things I'll be saying are really very old. They go back 10, 20, and even more years. But I'll try to put some modern spin on them. I'll present them from a more modern perspective. Some of the results are published, some of them are not published, but I'll continue in the tradition of earlier speakers here. I'll give no references whatsoever. So if you feel you're the main contributor to one of these fields, feel now that you have just been referenced to. My point of view, well, but I'll continue in this tradition and give references only to myself. So, so if you really want to see references and links to earlier papers, I'll be describing here work and points of view that I developed myself, partly with Juan Maldacena, and were published in various papers that I wrote during the last year or so, 2 years or so. And the last reference is a paper with Davis and Lawson. So in the spirit, since this is a school, I will not just talk about this particular subject. On occasions, I'll have a little detour to make comments of general interest and things that I think every practitioner in the field should know. So in the first talk, I'll start with a world sheet description and a target space description of this system. And I'm going to limit myself to the two-dimensional string, as the title said. And we have a world sheet Lagrangian, which is 1 over 4 pi alpha prime. It has two fields, phi and x. And there's a coupling. To the world sheet curvature. So this is a free world sheet theory, so we should be able to solve it, and that's what we will do now. Everything I say in the next 10 minutes or so is already in Pulchinski volume 1, so it's really elementary. The stress tensor derived from this world sheet Lagrangian is minus 1 over alpha prime, d phi square, oops, the same phi. Plus, there's a term with Q, which I'll soon set its value to a certain constant, d squared phi. This is known as an improvement term. We set C equals 26. And we get one from X, another one from phi, and another correction because of the improvement term, which is 3Q squared. and it's actually in my conventions, it's 6 alpha prime q square. We set that equal to 26, and therefore q is 2 over root alpha prime, which I've already used here. So for simplicity, I'll occasionally set alpha prime equals a half so that the equations are not too awkward. And we can compute dimensions of fields, vertex operators. E to the ipx has dimension a half p square. And dimension of e to the alpha phi is minus a half. There's an alpha square, but there's a correction due to the improvement term q. What the improvement term does for us, this coupling to the worksheet curvature and the shift in the dimensions and the shift in the stress tensor, it amounts to having a linear dilaton in space-time. So the dilaton is q times phi, and therefore g string is e to the q over 2 phi. It grows. So a picture of the target space, which I'll keep here for later reference, is that space is in this direction, phi. Phi near minus infinity, we have weak coupling in my convention. And phi goes to plus infinity, we have strong coupling. The coordinate x, I'll follow Schenker's tradition, will be either Euclidean time or Lorentzian time. And I'll try to remember to tell you when it's Lorentzian and when it is Euclidean. What is the physics? Well, we'll be standing here at the weak coupling end of space. So phi is space and x is time. We'll be standing here at the weak coupling end of space, where g string is arbitrarily small. By going sufficiently far, g string becomes arbitrarily small. The quantum fluctuations are not important. And it's very easy to analyze the physics. We will later see that despite its simplicity, it can be surprising. So we stand here, and we are going to throw stuff into the strong coupling region. Somehow, out of the strong coupling region, it will emerge back. And this will be our main observables, S-matrix elements that we throw in stuff from here and watch it come back out. What can we throw in? We can throw in the small fluctuations in this background, which are the particles. What are the particles? Well, we start this in traditional string theory. We should have a graviton, a beam u nu field, and a dilaton d. How many degrees of freedom do they have? Well, graviton, if you just follow the general formula from d dimension, has minus 1 degree of freedom. In d dimensions, the graviton always has d plus 1 over 2. These are the number of components in the metric, minus 2d, the gauge conditions. You substitute d equals 2, and you see that the graviton in two dimensions has minus 1 degree of freedom. What does it mean that it has minus 1 degree of freedom? It means that even though there's a potential dilaton in the problem, which is a scalar field, together the graviton and the dilaton have no degrees of freedom at all. And the beam u nu is really not interesting. So this is good news and bad news. Bad news is gravity is not too exciting in two dimensions. The good news is it will be really easy to analyze this string theory. The bottom line is that we cannot throw in dilatons or graviton. The second thing we can throw in is a tachyon, the same tachyon that exists in the bosonic string. But as we will see now, it is a massless field. So the word tachyon is really misleading here, so we should put it in quotation marks. So we have the stress tensor. We have the worksheet. So we can write vertex operators for the tachyon. So what can the vertex operator look like? Well, it has to be a plane wave. So I'll go now to Lorentzian signature. T is Lorentzian, is Ix. X is Euclidean, and T is Lorentzian. And the vertex operator has a plane wave, e to the minus I, e, t minus phi. And now we add here e to the power q over 2 phi. This factor can be thought of as being g string. Remember, g string is e to the q over 2 phi. And this is a plane wave in the 2 phi directions. This mode is, and we can also have another mode, a friend of this one, which is minus IE t plus phi times e to the q over 2 phi. And you can check that these are good vertex operators. What is the physics of these? Well, energy is always positive. One of them depends on t minus phi, the other depends on t plus phi. So that means that these modes are incoming modes, or right moving, and these modes, which depend on t plus phi, are outgoing modes, or left moving. So the picture of what we're doing is the following. We send some stuff from the weak coupling end here. This is time, t. So modes come in like that, and they are reflected in this way. And notice that I drew them in 45 degrees because these are massless particles. And we see that they have the dispersion relations of massless particles up to this G string. What is the Euclidean version of this story? Notice that we have half as many modes as in standard two-dimensional field theory. In standard two-dimensional field theory, we can have left incoming and outgoing modes, which are, every one of them could be either right moving or left moving. In other words, we can scatter both from here and from here, and we can scatter two either here or here. In this system, we have only one asymptotic region, which is over there. Nothing comes, nothing goes through here. So that's why we have half as many modes. What's the Euclidean version of this statement? If we just write these vertex operators in Euclidean space, they have the form e to the I px, x is Euclidean time, plus q over 2 minus p absolute value phi. So these two vertex operators have this form. Notice that I put p absolute value here because the analytic continuation to Euclidean signature is different for this and that, and they combine together to an expression like that. P can be either positive or negative or zero. This vertex operator has the e to the q over 2 phi, which was just copied from there, but the part of it which is the wave function is minus p phi. That means that its wave function diverges at the strong coupling end. Sorry, at the weak coupling end. So this is, can be thought of as a deformation of the background, which is not normalizable. We stand out here at the weak coupling end, and we specify boundary conditions, that this scalar field has exponential growth in this region. And that's the way we perturb the background. If we put boundary conditions that the field goes to zero at infinity, that it is normalizable, then we will have to say that this is a fluctuating mode on which we cannot put boundary conditions. So all the boundary conditions that we put, and this statement is also true in ADS CFT, it's also true in physics in general, it has nothing to do with string theory, you specify boundary conditions for modes which do not have compact support. Mode which has compact support has to be summed over. Modes which diverge at infinity or go to constant at infinity can be specified by boundary conditions. So the way we calculate is we specify boundary conditions at the weak coupling end, things which diverge there. We say how fields diverge there. That picks the right branch of the solution, or the right solution of the second order differential equation. And then we let the system evolve. What is the space-time Lagrangian that follows from these things? So the Lagrangian, again, follows, this is space-time. It has 1 over g string square of phi. And then it has a kinetic term for the tachyon. And since it's a tachyon, it has negative mass square. And there are higher order terms. And there are higher order terms which go beyond the tree. The tree has 1 over G string square. Given that G string square is exponential in phi, this is e to the minus 2 root 2 phi. We define a new field, T tilde, which is e to the minus root 2 phi times T. We substitute it in here, and we learn that the space-time Lagrangian is dT tilde square plus total derivative plus dot, dot, dot. In other words, this is clearly a massless field. And the transformation from T to T tilde really amounts to stripping this factor of G string, which appears here in the Q over 2 phi, appears here in the Q over 2 phi, et cetera. Sorry? Yes. Oh, yeah, in this Lagrangian, it looks more like a tachyon. But by change of variables, I've exhibited the fact that it's actually massless. So if you look in the 26-dimensional Lagrangian, you will see something that looks like that, but G string is independent of phi. By redefining, using the fact that G string depends on phi, the mass of the tachyon is shifted, and it's no longer tachyonic. It will retain its name, even though its nature is different. It retains its name because of the analogy to the 26-dimensional tachyon. But this change of variables really removes the T square. And you can do the exercise. Just substitute this in here, integrate by parts, and you see that you get this. And if it doesn't work, it's because I got some of the coefficients here wrong, not because the qualitative factor is wrong. So in this particular system, the story I've told you is a little bit incomplete. It's incomplete for 2 reasons. The system as I presented it here, for reasons that are not obvious at the moment, what will be completely obvious tomorrow, is non-perturbatively ill-defined. And furthermore, even perturbatively, it's ill-defined, because stuff is not going to come back out of the strong coupling region. Instead, in order to make it sensible, at least in perturbation theory, we should excite the tachyon. So in order to get reflection of the strong coupling region, we are going to turn on a background. For T, which is e to the phi times the coefficient mu. Occasionally, you will also see it written e to the phi, e to the phi. I'm not going to distinguish between these two. It will not be important for our purposes. This is a solution of the equations of motion. And it has the effect of giving a potential on the wall sheet. It looks like that. It goes up in the strong coupling region. And therefore, our scattering is off this potential. So this potential guarantees that if we throw stuff into the strong coupling region, it comes back before it hits the strong coupling region. The characteristic point of this potential is phi for order log mu, or 1 over minus log mu. From here, this is the curve. We can write the log mu here in the exponent. So there's a minus sign. This is the point where the potential turns up. And using this formula for G string that we had, it set G string, the effective G string, to be of order 1 over mu. So we can make the theory more and more weakly coupled by making mu larger and larger. In other words, we can make this mu larger. It pushes the potential to the left. The reflection will happen at smaller values of phi, more negative values of phi, where the string coupling is weaker. So this is how we should think of weak coupling in this system. And if we take this potential, we put it in the Wall sheet theory is no longer free, as it was in my earlier presentation. It's still solvable, and the literature there's huge literature on the subject, including this interaction term, where people calculated 3 amplitudes, D brains, Torus, et cetera. But I will not do it here. I really want to discuss an extension of this system, which is a little bit more interesting because it's supersymmetric, it has deep, interesting D-brains, it has Ramon-Ramon fluxes, and the bonus is that it makes sense non-perturbatively. So this is a place to stop for questions. Are there any? I don't know how much you've learned of elementary string theory and more advanced string theory. So far, should I double the speed, half the speed, stay as is? Thank you. So this is all I wanted to say about the bosonic string. And now we'll do the same thing for the superstring, or more precisely, I should say, with the fermionic string. This is a string theory that in Polchinski's terminology is called type zero string. This is type zero as opposed to type two because the left movers and the right movers have the same spin structure. So we have fermions on the world sheet and they have spin structure. The left movers and the right movers have the same spin structure. So, boy, type zero. In the old days, it was called the fermionic string. So on the world sheet, we no longer have a theory whose critical dimension is 26, but a theory whose critical dimension is 10. We have world sheet supersymmetry for the left movers and for the right movers. And we have to perform a certain GSO projection. So let me define, denoted by little f left and by little f right, to be distinguished by big F left and big F right, which will be defined later. These are left slash, put it like that. Fermion number. And then we perform a projection, a GSO projection, and then the NS and S sector we project on minus one to the F left plus minus to the F right equals one. In the Ramon-Ramon sector, we have two options, minus one to the F left plus F right equals, I'll move this here, equals one, we'll refer to this theory as zero B, or minus one, we'll refer to it as zero A. And we are not going to have an NSRO and RNS sector. In other words, this is not type two theory. We're not going to have NSR or RNS because we said that the spin structures for the left movers and the right movers is the same. In order to have space-time fermions, we need RNS or NSR for which the world sheet is such is chiral. And the left movers and the right movers have different spin structures. So I understand that you know a little bit about the ghost and the super ghost and Friedan, Martinek, and Schenker work, so I'll assume that you know that, and I'll just write the vertex operators. And I'll start with the zero B theory. The zero B theory still has an NS tachyon. This is a close relative of the tachyon we have seen in the bosonic string. It still has a misnomer. We call it a tachyon, but we'll put the tachyon in quotation marks because it will end up being massless. So what's the vertex operator? So this thing, which is var phi, is the bosonized ghost. We have such an object for the left movers and the right movers. And we have IPX, this is the momentum. And we have one minus P absolute value phi. So again, we have two coordinates, phi and x, exactly as before. We tune q, the improvement terms after the central charge is right. In this case, q is equal to one in my conventions. So that's the q equals to two, so that's why we have a one here. And this is the same absolute value that we saw here. And this is an on-shell vertex operator. You see that the x dependence and the phi dependence are linear in the momentum. And that's the characteristic of a massless particle. And it has a left moving and a right moving mode. So it can come in and it can go back out. depending on the sine of p. We also have a Ramon-Ramon field. Which I'll denote by C. I'll call this guy T, Takyo, and this is C. Here I'll be in the minus a half picture. And it is called, the vertex operators have this form. The superghosts come from, are associated with the picture. We have two left moving and two right moving fermions on the worksheet, which we bosonize. This is standard formalism of string theory. So we have H plus H bar plus IPX plus 1 minus P absolute value phi. And we have another guy, E to the minus phi over 2, minus phi bar over 2, plus I, sorry, minus I. I'd like to make a few comments here that people who really mastered Polchinski's book shouldn't be a big deal for them. The fact that the relative sign between H and H bar is the same is because of the projection. We don't have H minus H bar. This was projected out here. The sign here should be correlated with the sign of P. So this is true only for P positive. And this is true only for P negative. That's because for Ramon-Ramon fields, in addition to the mass shell condition, we also have to impose the Dirac equation, which comes from BRST invariance. So this mode has only positive P. This one has only negative P. That means that one of them is left moving, the other is right moving. The next comment I'd like to make is that these vertex operators do not create one quantum with the proper normalization. These vertex operators create one quantum. If you wish, these are vertex operators for the field strength, not for the potential. So one should always think of Ramon-Ramon fields as being gauge fields. In this case, the gauge symmetry is really trivial, but that's, it fits in the general picture where the C field is a gauge field. So this is really a vertex operator for this field, and this is for D minus C. So C is a massless scalar, and the vertex operator has the normalization that it creates a field strength, which is the derivative of C. And this one creates also a derivative, but with the other chirality. One way to see that is that e to the I h over 2 is a spin field in two dimensions. We have another spin field for the right movers, a spin field for the left movers, spin field for the right movers, but they are coupled together so that the whole thing has spin 1. It has spin 1, and that, which means it has two components. Yet another way of saying it, C is a massless field. It's a function of x plus I phi and x minus I phi. The D plus projects on one part and the D minus projects on the other. In addition to these, so this is standard, that this is simply the two-dimensional reduction of things which you should have seen by now many times. But what is rarely mentioned is the fact that we can also put zero momentum here and zero momentum here. Now, if we substitute zero momentum here or here, superficially it means that we put a zero mode of C in. We send in a C field with zero momentum. That's slightly imprecise. It's imprecise because what is a constant, if we set P equals zero, there's no X dependence. So what is independent of X is not C, but it's D plus of C. And if we send this guy in, it's not that we send a C field at zero momentum, but we send a D minus C at zero momentum. In other words, there are the following classical solutions for the C fields. The C field is a massless field. It has two zero modes, which I'll call nu phi plus nu tilde P. Now I switch to Lorentzian signature because I call it P, Euclidean signature, it's an X. So such a linear solution, something which is linear in phi or in t, is a solution of the equations of motion. And what these vertex operators at zero momentum do, they give us backgrounds for nu and nu tilde. Actually, one of them is left moving, the other is right moving. So we will also be using the notation nu in times t minus phi plus nu out of t plus phi. So one of these, I think the minus creates this, nu in is created by this, and nu out is created by that. Equivalently, we have this nu and nu tilde. Why am I spending so much time with these zero momentum subtleties, which are rarely discussed? These parameters, nu and nu tilde, will describe our backgrounds. So when you hear talks about flux vacua, what flux vacua are, they are correspond to turning on constant Ramon-Ramon flux. The Ramon-Ramon flux that can exist in the system subject to the equations of motion. And that's what we can do here. So nu and nu tilde, or equivalently, the linear combinations nu in and nu out are Ramon-Ramon flux. So the system is going to be characterized by two parameters, nu and nu tilde. And our goal is to understand the physics of this Ramon-Ramon. This is one of our goals, is to understand the physics of these Ramon-Ramon fluxes. So I'm repeating what I said for the, in the bosonic string. We take this Lagrangian in space-time. The scattering is still the same. We come from here, we send stuff in and out. We have a tachyon field, which is either going this way or that way. And we have a scalar field, one mode created by this vertex operator is incoming, another mode created by this vertex operator is outgoing. So this, the physics is that we sit here at infinity. We have two diagnostics of the system. We can either throw in T fields or we can throw in C fields. And we wait very long, and then we watch what comes out. And there are either C fields or T fields or both that come out. So what is the Lagrangian? First approximation, we have something like this, except that because the value of Q is different and we are in the superstring, the coefficient here is 1, and there is no root 2 here. I do something that is usually considered bad practice for the speaker, is to use an existing equation on the blackboard that it takes you longer to copy. So I'll wait a second. So this is the Lagrangian of the T field. It's a massless field, very much like in the bosonic string. But now we also have this C field. So to leading approximation, its kinetic term is dC squared. Notice that it's just massless to begin with. It does not have G string in front of it. This is characteristic also in higher dimensions. The kinetic, the properly normalized kinetic term of Ramon-Ramon field does not have the one over G string in front of it, one over G string square in front of it. So this is the Lagrangian. We'll soon consider some of the higher order corrections to this Lagrangian. In order to do that, we would like to understand the symmetries. So this system is going to be a very subtle and complicated system. So we should try and make as much as possible use of the symmetries of the system that will tell us things that are true regardless of the complicated interactions. The symmetries are things which we can trust even whenever we are confused. This is a general rule in physics. So what are the symmetries of the system? So we look at the Wolschmidt Lagrangian. We can ask, what are the symmetries? So one thing is already fermion number, left and right. The other symmetry, which I'll soon discuss because it is interesting, the system has a kind of trivial Z2 symmetry, which acts as minus 1 to the big F left. So my notation is that big F left is the left moving in the Wolschmidt space-time . This is a very confusing definition, so let me be a little bit more precise about it. The Wolschmidt has left movers and right movers. Let's only consider the left movers on the Wolschmidt. Forget the right movers on the Wolschmidt. they can make space-time fermions. The theory does not have space-time fermion. But from the worldsheet point of view, we can be in the Ramon sector, which corresponds to space-time fermions. For them, F left is 1. If we are in the NS sector, F left is 0. If we are in the Ramon sector, F left is 1. So that symmetry acts as NS goes to NS. And Ramon is mapped to minus Ramon. So this is a symmetry that acts as minus 1 on all the Ramon fields. So it takes T to T, and it takes C to minus C. In plain English, this will be charge conjugation. We will later see that the C field has D brains associated with it, which carry charge. There will be fluxes in the system. If we want to flip the sign of the charge, this is called charge conjugation. This is achieved by flipping the sign of the C field. In higher dimensions, where the C field has cousins which have Lorentz indices, for example, a gauge field, this is the symmetry that flips the sign of the photon, and that's usually called charge conjugation. So this Z2 symmetry, the trivial one, on the worldsheet it acts like this. And in space-time, it is called charge conjugation. The second Z2 symmetry is much more interesting, and we're going to get some mileage out of it. Usually, the more interesting the symmetry, the more mileage you get out of it. I've already defined little f left and little f right. Little f left and little f right were simply the fermion number in the worldsheet sense, coming from the left movers or the right movers. Another Z2. Which acts as minus 1 to just worldsheet F left. Our projection was such that minus 1 to the F left plus F right is always 1 or minus 1. So that's not an interesting symmetry. But this does act as an interesting symmetry. What does it do? It takes, first of all, T to minus T. It flips the sign of the tachyon. If we look at the Ramon fields, recall we had these two vertex operators, and we can tell how each vertex operator transforms under the Z2 symmetry. So C plus, C left moving, goes to C plus. C minus goes to minus C minus. This is a very strange symmetry. We take a scalar field, and for the T field, we just flip its sign. This is something we are used to. But for the C field, it's a little bit more interesting. We break it into a left moving and its right moving components, and we flip the sign of the left movers, keeping the right movers intact. Have we seen such symmetries before? Yeah, where? Duality, very good. So this is exactly what we do in duality. With one exception. The duality that you have seen, where this thing happens, is duality on the worldsheet. And that's why it's called T-duality. The duality that we perform now is not duality on the worldsheet. C is a space-time field. It's not a worldsheet field. So we take a space-time field, we break it to left movers and right movers, and we flip the sign of the left movers. So this is duality in space-time. So I'll call it S-duality. We already see a glimpse here of our ability to analyze the system at strong coupling. We haven't done any calculation. We don't care what the interactions are. We sit out there at infinity where everything is weakly coupled, and we recover an interesting S-duality. And if the interactions on the worldsheet break this symmetry, there are some parameters there which break the symmetry, no problem, it just means that the background does not preserve S-duality, but S-duality allows us to relate different backgrounds with different values of the parameters. Let me extract some consequences of that symmetry. I had this expansion of C, which I'm sure you can read here, in terms of nu and nu tilde. So the left mover and the right mover part were nu in and nu out. So this symmetry flips the sign of nu in without changing the sign of nu out. In other words, what this symmetry does, it exchanges nu and nu tilde. So these two Ramon-Ramon fluxes that the system can have are exchanged under this S-duality symmetry, which means that if we solve the system as a function of nu, set nu tilde to zero, with no work, we also solve the system as a function of nu tilde with nu equals zero. The Lagrangian that we had over there, shall I call it the space-time, had, among other things, dc squared. So it has a symmetry, c goes to c plus a constant. We will later see that as in 10 dimensions, this shift symmetry of the Ramon-Ramon scalar is not an exact symmetry of the theory. However, we would like to have this S-duality. How can we have, what do we know of a scalar field if it has to have this S-duality? Normally, a scalar field, non-compact scalar field, does not have such a symmetry. In order to have this symmetry, the scalar field has to be compact, and it has to be compactified at exactly the same rate. At a particular radius. So what the S-duality tells us, that C is compact, i.e. C is identified with C plus 2 pi root 2, I guess, in my conventions. Maybe I'll call it C naught. Where C naught, this radius, is exactly the self-dual radius. So again, without doing any work, we learn that C is not any garden variety scalar field, but it's a compact scalar field at the self-dual radius. This immediately has some consequences that you have learned off on the worldsheet, and now we play exactly the same game in space-time. If we have a scalar field at the self-dual radius, then the system has an SU2 cross SU2 symmetry. This will end up not being a symmetry of the full theory, but is an exact non-perturbative symmetry in the asymptotic region. So in the asymptotic weak coupling region, I stressed it only here, there is an SU2 incoming. So there's an SU2 incoming and an SU2 outgoing, SU2 of the left mover C field and an SU2 of the right moving C field. So all the quanta that we sent in, all the solitons we would like to consider, and you will see that we'll have to consider them, come in representations of SU2. All those that come out are also in a representation of SU2. But it's not the same SU2. There's a separate SU2 that acts on the incoming and a separate SU2 that acts on the outgoing modes. So there's something in the system as we move inside. So we started over there, we see an SU2 symmetry in our spectrum. And we come in to the strong coupling region, and something in there will break the symmetry and will reflect things out. If it didn't break the symmetry and we send in an SU2 triplet, it cannot come back out as an SU2 triplet, because this is another SU2 symmetry. So the system has two separate SU2s, and there should be something in the strong coupling region that maps a state in some representation of one SU2 to a state in another representation of SU2. So a toy model for the physics of this is the following. Imagine this is our space, and it has a boundary. Very much like in the worldsheet, but now we're doing it in space-time. So there is a boundary, and we reflect something off the boundary, like that. And if we have SU2 cross SU2 in the bulk, the boundary conditions are always such that they tell us how the left-moving SU2 is reflected out as in right-moving SU2. If we just look at the naive Lagrangian that we wrote down, so we had d tilde square plus dc square, this Lagrangian has many more symmetries, even if c is compactified at the right radius. In addition to all the z2 symmetries, we have a lot more. For example, this z2 symmetry is such that t flips psi and c is dualized. But this Lagrangian has more symmetry. We can just flip the sign of t tilde or of t with or without changing, with or without dualizing t, c. The leading correction to this Lagrangian is the following. We have here e to the 2t. So this is a high-order interaction that couples t and c. And you can see that it is invariant under our z2 symmetry. What happens under t duality, or under this s duality, we dualize the c field. So let's do it by hand. T or t tilde flip sign. So that remains invariant. T gets a minus sign, so there's a minus sign in the exponent. And now we have dc tilde squared here. C tilde is the dual field. And that's just as well, because the coefficient of dc squared has to be the inverse of the coefficient of dc tilde squared. So the t-duality symmetry is an exact symmetry of the theory. This is not going to be ruined by any interaction. The coupling between c and t is the leading order correction that breaks the SU2 cross SU2 symmetry. In other words, if t is non-zero, then as we move in, imagine t is positive, the coefficient here becomes bigger. And as the coefficient becomes bigger, the radius of compactification of the C field becomes bigger, and we go away from the self-dual radius. And by doing that, we ruin the SU2 cross SU2 symmetry. But the S duality, this symmetry, remains correct. And in fact, this is an exact non-perturbative symmetry of the system. So these are the leading order terms in our Lagrangian. And now let's analyze the physics that come from these terms. Are there any questions? The second term, you mean this term? And under which symmetry? Yes, let's do it again. We mapped S duality from here to here. So T flipped sign, that's why I got a minus sign in the exponent. And C was dualized, and I put a C, that's why I put C tilde. But when we put C tilde, when we do the transformation, well, it's the active and passive of symmetries, I always get it wrong. When you, let's just stay here. When you do T duality or S duality, the radius goes to the inverse radius. And that means that the coefficient here should become the inverse. The coefficient should be the inverse. And the inverse is achieved by putting a minus sign here. So this Lagrangian is really invariant under S duality. It's written like that in the dual variables. That means that it's invariant. Okay, good. I'm glad you asked. So we had this definition that C was nu phi plus nu tilde t. And I also wrote it as nu in t minus phi plus nu out t plus phi. So this is C plus, and this is C minus. Whenever we have a massless scalar field, we can write it as a linear combination of a function of t plus phi and a function of t minus phi. Normally, we refer to them as left movers and right movers. Here, because we scatter only from the left, all the right moving guys are incoming and all the left moving guys are outgoing. So flipping the sign of one or the other amounts to exchanging nu and nu tilde. And this is what the duality transformation does. Yes? That's correct. Okay, that's absolutely correct. I first wrote the leading order Lagrangian just from looking at the spectrum with this is it. And now there are higher order corrections. And there are various higher order corrections. There are corrections which have higher powers of the fields, and there are higher order corrections which have higher powers of derivative. So if we stay within two derivatives, one can argue that this is the most general term. I didn't do it here. I just quoted the answer. And as a check, I show that it respects the symmetries of the problem. Notice that it has this, the C goes to minus C. Absolutely, absolutely. That's a good comment. Let's analyze this Lagrangian in a little bit more detail, especially this part of the Lagrangian, because we'll extract some physics. Right? And again, I'll try to emphasize the things which are generic, things that you also see in higher dimensions, rather than the peculiarities of this system. So I mentioned that it might be a good idea to turn on a background tachyon, to reflect the incoming modes back out already at tree level. So we are going to turn on T, which I'll also write it, I'll drop the expectation value, is mu e to the phi. And let's look at the equation of motion for C. Said a lot, C is a massless field, and it has terms, solutions, which are linear in T and phi. All this is being corrected by the interaction with the tachyon. So the equation of motion for T is D e to the 2T C DC equals 0. And the solution is C equals nu integral up to phi e to the minus 2T of phi d phi plus nu tilde t. So the solution we had before is modified this way. At the weak coupling region, the exponential here is not important. T goes to 0. This is 1. This becomes a term linear in phi, and it goes over to our previous solution. But as we move into the strong coupling region, this term makes a big difference. What is the norm of the field phi? The norm of the field phi, we have deformations or we have fluctuations. The norm square is usually written as d phi times the term which comes from the kinetic term. This is special. This is always true whenever we have a kinetic term which is not canonical. The norm gets a correction due to the metric in the target space, which is this. These two facts, this is the form of the classical solutions, and this is the norm, is now going to restrict the kind of fluctuations that we can have, or the kind of deformation. So to be concrete, let mu be positive. So the coefficient here is positive. So the coefficient here is negative in the exponent. So this term goes to 0 very rapidly as phi goes to plus infinity. Goes to 0 very rapidly. And therefore, the norm of this deformation is finite in the strong coupling region. So the term nu integral up to phi is normalizable as phi goes to plus infinity. So there's nothing wrong with that mode. We can have such a deformation. Recall, it's not normalizable at the weak coupling end, because it grows linearly in phi. This mode is not normalizable at the weak coupling end, so it's a good boundary condition to specify. And at the strong coupling end, in the leading approximation, it just grew linearly in phi, but the interaction with the tachyon takes it to be very, very small. Nu tilde, on the other hand, the deformation with nu tilde, is not suppressed at the strong coupling region. And now when we compute its norm, it has infinite norm. And of course, it has also infinite norm as phi goes to minus infinity. What does it mean that we have a field which has a strong divergence in our background, in the interior of our background? There's nothing wrong with such a thing. What it tells us is that there's an object sitting there. We know that the potential, electric potential around an electron is 1 over r. It has a singularity at r equals 0. It's clearly not normalizable. What does it mean? Well, there's nothing wrong with that. It just means that there's an object sitting there which sources that background. So therefore, this thing, unlike this background deformation, this background deformation is sourced by an object at phi equals infinity. This is not. We have seen that this morning in Ofer Aharoni's talk, when he had a divergence in the interior of his ADS. He said, okay, no big deal. It just means that there's something sitting there. Now, it's often the case that we can find such divergences, singularities of solutions, and that's often the case. And the theory might or might not have objects which correspond to them that could really source them. Both in Ofer Aharoni's talk and here, the theory does have such an object. We will later see that this is an infinite array of D-brains which source this field. But here comes a little surprise. We had a symmetry in our problem, our Z2 symmetry, our favorite Z2 symmetry, that exchanges T with minus T and nu with tilde with minus nu tilde. I'm not going to erase that because I need it again. So without doing much work, we immediately see what the situation is when we flip the sign of mu. Because T goes to minus T, leads to mu goes to minus mu. So we can turn on the T field with positive or with negative coefficient. So we analyzed over there what happens when mu is positive. So now what happens when mu is negative? Well, mu tilde T has finite norm. How much time do I still have? Ah, thank you. So nu tilde T has finite norm. So it is not sourced by a D-brain. It's not sourced by an object. However, the other deformation, nu, the integral up to phi, and I'm not going to copy it again, has infinite norm and therefore sourced by an object. So we didn't have to do the calculation again, although we could have done it as an exercise. It's not that difficult. This result is really surprising. It's really surprising because imagine we sit here at weak coupling. We don't see whether we turn on mu, whether mu is a 1 or mu is minus 1. This is totally negligible here. And we can even imagine changing mu continuously from being plus 1 to being minus 1. And if you want to stay within, and we stay in the same region in space-time, here the coupling constant is essentially 0. There's nothing funny going on. The tachyon field is negligible, and we change mu a little bit. So as far as we are concerned, not much has happened. We stay here in space-time, in a very, very small field flipped its sign. Who cares? It is 10 to the minus 100 here, and we don't care whether it's plus 10 to the minus 100 or minus 10 to the minus 100. This makes a big difference in the interior But for local physics here, it makes no difference. So the small change in mu at the weak coupling, which is totally negligible at the weak coupling end, has a dramatic consequence at the strong coupling end. If we put flux in the system, we got flux that was sourced by D-brains, or flux which is not sourced by D-brains. And as we vary the parameter mu, there is no phase transition between them. So we can sit here with a knob that changes the background field. So we change the background mu from being 10 to the minus 100 to minus 10 to the minus 100. Everything is perfectly smooth as we do that. But somewhere in the strong coupling region, the flux had to change dramatically from something which diverges to something that does not diverge. But we here don't see any effect of that. And correspondingly, it should be interpreted as coming from D-brains or not coming from D-brains. This phenomenon has already been seen before, but much less explicitly than that, mostly in the work on topological strings. Well, we have some D-brains that we put in the space-time, but we have a continuous transition between a situation where a D-brain sits in space-time, there's a genuine singularity in the background fields, and certain flux going through a cycle in the manifold. And there is no transition between these two situations. So what we have here is an explicit realization of the same idea, except that by the end of these lecture sets, I'll have explicit formulas, including all the non-perturbative corrections to everything, and we'll see that everything is analytic function of mu, and we'll exhibit the dependence on mu and mu tilde. So again, in one quote-unquote phase, say mu positive, mu is generated by D-brains, mu tilde is not generated by D-brains. In the other phase, when we change the sign of mu, we have to switch the roles of mu and mu tilde. And most importantly, using the word phase is really misleading because there is no phase transition between these two phases. The transition from one side to the other is perfectly smooth. Before we finish this discussion, let's turn on nu. So I'm continuing in the spirit of this talk, of today's lecture. I'm only the weak coupling end. I'm around here. I have some qualitative understanding of what's going on in the strong coupling region, but I don't want to make it very quantitative. We will make it quantitative. But for the time being, imagine that mu tilde is zero, and nu is not zero. Then the Lagrangian has a term, dc squared. And let me suppress the e to the t. So that behaves like nu squared. So the energy of the system is the volume of space-time, which is infinite. I'll call it log lambda. This is the volume of space, times nu squared. So if we have Ramon-Ramon flux, it's very easy. We have the same thing in four dimensions. If we turn on electric field, then the energy that we get, energy density, is E square. Energy square is the electric field square, and the total energy is the electric field square. This is the analog of the electric field times the volume. Recall nu is not the C field, but the gradient of the C field. So this is the volume of space, or the volume of phi. And that's infinite. But this is an infinite extensive quantity. There are corrections to this formula which are not extensive. They are associated with physics in the strong coupling region. We will compute them. But for the moment, let us just be interested in the extensive quantities, quantities which scale like the volume. So this is not very surprising. The C field has constant gradient, and therefore, we get a term proportional to nu squared. And even if we put the e to the 2t here, it's not going to affect the extensive part, because the e to the 2t T is 1 in that region. Next exercise, we'll do the same thing with nu tilde non-zero and nu equals 0. And what are we going to get? Well, we have our favorite symmetry. We get the same thing. Log lambda times nu tilde squared. That's easy. The symmetry allows us to do that. But what happens when both nu and nu tilde are non-zero? In this case, we run into a puzzle. So now we're going to turn on both the nu flux and the nu tilde flux. We are going to learn a little bit about Ramon-Ramon fluxes. So we describe both of them as some gradient of the C field. So imagine the C field has a gradient. The gradient has components both in the phi direction and in the T direction. So let us first review what happened in these two situations. The gradient of the C field was either in the space direction or in the time direction. Using this S duality, we can say that it's only in the space direction. So these two situations are really time-independent situations. So even if C was linear in time, we can go to the field C tilde, and it is linear in space. So this is a situation which is time independent. But if both nu and nu tilde are non-zero, we really have a situation which is genuinely time dependent. In that case, it's better to work in terms of nu in and nu out. So the stress tensor, this T is the stress tensor, not to be confused with the tachyon field. T plus is the plus plus derivative, depends only on the derivative or the gradient of C in the plus direction. That is nu in square. And T minus minus is proportional to nu out square. So what is our story? We send in some stuff from here. We got it back here. But the flux of energy is not conserved. So the flux is really this integral on whatever it's called here, psi plus. In the previous situation, where either nu or nu tilde is 0, these two quantities are the same. They're kind of the sum and the difference of nu and nu tilde. But if both are non-zero, the amount of flux we send in is not the same as the amount of flux we get out. So that means that this is, as it stands, an inconsistent background. The past by itself is consistent. The future by itself is consistent. But this combination of past and future cannot possibly be consistent. Example would be, take a situation with some energy. That's a good incoming state. Take a situation with some energy, which is different energy. That's a good outgoing state. But together, there cannot be a consistent scattering experiment because the energy in the past has to be the same as the energy in the future. How can we fix that? Well, we have to fix that by adding more quanta. C or T quanta. In order to restore the balance in the energy. And there are lots of ways of doing it. What's the minimal way of doing it? Well, the minimal will be to take the bigger of the two, say nu in is bigger than nu out, and not mess with it. So we have a lot of flux in the incoming state. In the outgoing state, we will take what we want, nu out, and we will correct the discrepancy here by adding more quanta. So the total energy in the system, the total flux in the system, or the total energy, which is what we are computing over there, so the total energy, okay, let's divide, compute the energy divided by the volume, so I don't have to write it all the time, is really the maximum of nu in square or nu out square. That's the true energy of the system. And it's a little exercise to see that this is up to some factors of two, which are not interesting, nu absolute value plus nu tilde absolute value square. You just go through all the possibilities of plus and minus sign, and you will see that nu in, the maximum of nu in and nu out is this thing. So this generalizes the formulas that we had here, either nu square or nu tilde square. But it generalizes them not by adding them together, but by adding also a cross term to nu nu tilde. And we interpret that as being associated with extra quanta that need to be added in order to have balance of the energy. In the remaining time, I'll run quickly through the zero A theory. And we will see a similar subtlety there, that when we turn on, there will be two kinds of fluxes. When we turn one of them on, it's simple, doesn't matter which one. And when we turn both of them on at the same time, we have to fix up the system. And we'll give a physical interpretation there, which is, will be somewhat different than this one. Are there any questions so far? So now I'm going to discuss the zero A system. I've already defined it in terms of being an opposite projection in the NS sector. So we still have the same tachyon we had before. But the Ramon-Ramon sector is projected out. There are no particles in the Ramon-Ramon sector. You can work it out yourself. What remains in the Ramon-Ramon sector are only zero momentum fields. So we see that we have no x dependence, and we set p to zero. That's our usual thing. The relative sign between h and h bar is opposite to the one we had in the zero B theory. That's characteristic of being in the zero A theory. The reason there are no states that propagate with non-zero momentum, because we said earlier that the coefficient, the sign in front of h, is correlated with the sign of p, but h and h bar have different signs. And the sign of P has to be the same for the left movers and the right movers. So all that remains is this zero momentum guy. Now, what is it? Well, first of all, in the zero A theory, we wouldn't expect zero forms, like the C field. We would expect gauge fields. Second, as I've already stressed, in this picture, the vertex operators do not correspond to gauge fields or to the fields themselves, but they correspond to the field strength. So this is really vertex operators for two different field strengths that exist in the system, denoted by plus and minus here. So the system, or I'll call them F and F tilde. So what these vertex operators correspond to is having Ramon-Ramon flux, very much like before, but this time they are not a gradient of a C field, but they are a field strength. Another way to see that is that e to the I h over 2 has spin a half, just as it was before. But the relative sign between h and h bar means that the left movers and the right movers contribute in opposite directions. So this whole contribution, e to this thing, carry space-time spin zero. And that's why it's like a field strength of a photon rather than being a gradient of a scalar. Right? The field strength in two dimensions is a scalar, because it has two indices, zero and one. So we can repeat the same thing we said before. We have a Lagrangian includes space-time Lagrangian, includes e to the 2t times f square, plus e to the minus 2t times f tilde square. The reason we know these are the coefficients is, again, our two Z2 symmetries. I'm going rapidly through them. We had these Z2 symmetries, charge conjugation, which flips the sign of f and f tilde, and our S duality symmetry. It's very similar to the previous case. So what it does, it takes t to minus t, f goes to f tilde, and f tilde goes to f, exchanges them. So just as before, we flip this and that, and the sign here is fixed by t goes to minus t. Unlike 0b, here both the field c, there c and c tilde did not appear as two separate fields in the Lagrangian. It was just one field which carries these both degrees of freedom. Here, they are described by two different fields. Sorry? Well, it's not interaction. This is really, this thing is 1 plus 2t plus whatever, half 2t squared plus dot, 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 f squared. So the term with 1 is the kinetic term, and the rest are interaction terms. And there are many higher order corrections which have more than two derivatives. But at the level of two derivatives, this is all we have. In some normalization, yeah. I was trying to be careful with the normalization, but don't trust me. It makes no difference for this thing whether it's two or not two. Where is the normalization? When we write the kinetic term for t, we can put here whatever number we want, but we have to be careful about the relative normalization between the coefficient here and the coefficient of dt squared. And the coefficient of dt square made no difference so far. So when you do actual computations, it's very important to get it straight. But for the qualitative discussion I'm doing here, it's not important. Nevertheless, I made an effort to be consistent. And in the papers that I did not refer to, people got the coefficients right. I think even in the papers that I did refer to, people got the coefficients. So we solve the equations of motion. Here it's easier than before. The solutions are q, e to the 2t, and f tilde is q tilde, e to the minus 2t, where the coefficients q and q tilde are kind of integration constants. And again, we have to go through the story, how they behave at infinity, and it's very much like what we had before. For mu positive, q is not sourced. It's here. By a brain. And q tilde is sourced by a brain. And for mu negative, it's the opposite. So again, we have this situation that as we vary mu, the flux that is sourced by the brain continuously becomes a flux which is not sourced by a brain. So there's complicated physics out there at infinity, where everything is strongly coupled and there are quantum fluctuations and all that. Semi-classically, in one limit, it looks like there's a brain there. And then as we make mu smaller and we pass through zero, the brain kind of dissolves. And by the time we are at the other side of mu, the brain is no longer there. And the brain is kind of gone. So there's really no precise notion of saying there is a D brain sitting there at infinity because we have a smooth transition between a situation with the brain and the situation without it. This is only true for this particular kind of brain. There are other brains where it's really meaningful. For these brains, it's not. Since I'm not going, well, I'll soon prove it, but first I'll try to give an intuitive reason. Before, C, we had a scalar field C, and its gradient could be non-zero. And since the gradient could be non-zero, it could be any number we wanted. It could be 3.5. There was nothing wrong with that. Here, this flux is the flux carried by electric field. And it can be sourced by a brain. So if something is flux is carried by electric field and it's sourced by a brain, it means that the vector potential in F couples directly to this brain. And therefore, the charge that it carries must be quantized. So both Q and Q tilde are quantized. That was not the case for nu and nu tilde that we had before. So we have charge in the system, which is quantized. This is the, in one phase, Q is quantized, in the other phase, Q tilde is quantized. But since we can freely change the sign of mu, Q and Q tilde are quantized all the time. Now let us compute the energy. I'm repeating the exercise we did in zero B theory. So we look at the Lagrange, and imagine only Q is non-zero. So set Q tilde to zero. And again, compute the energy per unit volume. So the e to the 2t is not important because we're only interested in the extensive part. We have an F square, and F square is like Q square. If Q is zero and Q tilde is non-zero, we get Q tilde square. So this is very much like before. And in fact, the analogy I made with electric field being constant in space, giving energy, E square is here very precise because it's not the gradient of a scalar that leads to the energy, but background electric field. What happens when both Q and Q tilde are non-zero? Well, by now we are experienced, and we know that things are not going to be easy. The naive answer is Q square coming from this term plus Q tilde square coming from this term. But by now we are experienced, we know this cannot be the right answer. And I'm going to motivate the right answer from two different points of view here. And later in the talk, depending on how much time I have, I'll try to make a more precise derivation of it. The simplest way to think about it is to recall that the zero B theory and the zero A theory are really t-dual to one another. If we compactify Euclidean time, we perform t-duality, the two systems are the same. And since this is really the reason why the zero A theory and the zero B theory, the zero A story and the zero B story are so similar. They're so similar because once we compactify time, they have to be exactly the same qualitatively, but not quantitatively. So in the zero B system, we noticed that we needed to send more particles. We needed more quanta. What's the t-dual version of it? The t-dual version of that is that we have to add more fundamental strings. Fundamental strings which are stretched along space. So this is argument number one. Argument number two, I remind to the more knowledgeable people in the audience of the D0, D8 system. When a D0 brain crosses a D8 brain, it leaves behind a fundamental string which is stretched. Similar things were seen in many other systems, in ADS-CFT, a baryon vertex has strings attached to it, and so forth. This situation always arises when we have the two kinds of fluxes which are related by duality present at the same time. This is when this situation arises. And I can write formulas to really explain it. This is exactly what happens here. These fields F and F tilde are very much like the fields of a D0 in a D8 system. So the upshot of all that is that in this case, when both Q and Q tilde are not zero, we need to add. And it's not that it's an option. Otherwise, the background is inconsistent. For the background to be consistent, we need to add Q, Q tilde fundamental string. stretched along phi. So in addition to these Ramon-Ramon fluxes, the system also has QQ tilde fundamental strings. And this is by far the quickest way to see that both Q and Q tilde have to be quantized, because the number of fundamental strings that we stretched along space has to be quantized. So now we can compute the energy per unit length is a piece proportional to Q square coming from here. There's a piece proportional to Q tilde square coming from here, coming from here. And there's a term coming from the QQ tilde fundamental string, which has to have an absolute value, because whether it's a string or an anti-string, depending on an orientation, it has the same energy. And if you put all the numbers in, it comes with a coefficient 2. So this is the energy. The energy is Q plus Q tilde square. So surprisingly, the physics of Q and the physics of Q tilde are totally different, but the final answer depends only on the sum of the absolute values. What's even more surprising is that if we get to it, we will show that this magic, that the two things combines into a perfect square, and that this depends only on the combination, will persist in the exact theory. Not only to all orders and perturbation theory, this is an exact result. From this point of view, it looks impossible. It looks really magical. Finally, I'd like to resolve one little paradox that I'm surprised nobody asked me about. In the zero, I said the following three statements, which superficially cannot be all consistent. I said that the zero A system is P dual to the zero B system. This is statement number one, if we compactify Euclidean time. Second statement I said is that these Qs must be quantized. And the third statement I said is that the nus, these fluxes in the zero B system, are not quantized. So let me explain how these three sentences, these three statements can be simultaneously consistent. So if we compactify Euclidean time, and let me start with the zero A system. So we have a circle. This is Euclidean time. And around the circle, and let's start only with Q, forget Q tilde. So we have these zero brains. So their world line wraps the circle. So there are Q of them. So this is our circle, Euclidean time. And these D brains wrap the circle, and there are Q of them. So they look like lines here because I describe time here, the Euclidean time. After T duality, the circle remains, well, with a slightly different radius, R goes to 1 over R. But the D brain, which is stretched around the circle, is replaced by points. So we have Q points around the circle. As we are going to take the radius to infinity, these points are going to become the instantons of the zero B theory. If Q is finite, and we just stretch the circle to infinity, these the instantons are not going to have any macroscopic effect. In order to have a macroscopic effect, we need to do the following. So here we have radius R. So here we have, say, radius 1 over R. So here, the total number of the instantons per unit length is Q over R. Now we are going to take R to infinity. In order to have a non-trivial effect, in order to have macroscopic physics affected by that, we will need to take Q to infinity, keeping nu, which is Q over R, fixed. So this answers several questions that you might have had. Number one, the relation between nu and Q is this relation. We start from D brains, obvious D brains, the zero brains in the zero A theory, which carry charge. Their number is quantized. After we compactify and we t-dualize and we take this R to infinity, we, in order to have a macroscopic effect, we have to take an infinite number of such D brains. And the ratio can indeed be anything. This explains why Q is quantized, but nu is not. That's the first question which is being answered. Second question, it also tells us what are these D brains which source nu and nu tilde. The D brains which source Q or Q tilde are the zero brains of the zero A theory. The D brains which source nu and nu tilde is an infinite number, a macroscopic number of D instantons. We have finite number of instantons per unit time. So the number of instantons in the system, remember, this is really a transition amplitude. We will compute it in more detail later. We have a transition amplitude from one situation to the next, from the past to the future. And the number of instantons which are needed in order to mediate the transition is macroscopic. It grows with the length of time, or it grows with the size of the system. And this is what nu corresponds to. So nu is, again, carried by D brains. There's a macroscopic number of them. And I finished about two-thirds of what I did. So I'll readjust more. How is the speed? Should I go faster or slower or the same? Not faster? What about slower? Who wants slower? Okay, thank you.